Okay, so first thing that you will notice is that I've changed the title that Boris gave me. But nonetheless, I think it conveys the same message. So I'm going to talk both about regulation, the role of regulation and architecture by abundant proteins in the bacterial cell that help shape the chromosome. But first, credits are due. I didn't do this work alone. So these are all the list of, this is a list of my collaborators, students, postdocs. So we have these people in my group at the Department of Physics and Complex Systems, and we collaborated intensively and very fruitfully with both Ofer Giladi and Amos Oppenheim, two molecular biologists and biochemists.
It's a physics talk rather than biology talk, because if it were a biology talk, you'd have to give credit that they have.
All right. So let me start by introducing a little cell that you all know, but I want to start from scratch. So this is E. coli, and this is a partial breakup of its components. As you can see, the DNA occupies a very small portion by weight in the cell. It is a closed molecule. It is essentially, it codes for about 4,500 different proteins, and it is concentrated in some sort of organelle called the nucleoid, which has been highlighted in this picture. And this bar gives you the appropriate scale. We're talking about cells that are on the order of 1 micron in diameter and 2 microns in length after they have just divided. So one can do a very simple experiment. These experiments were done in the past, and take some soap, put the bacteria in soap, and dissolve their membranes. And what you see after you do that is that all the DNA spills out. This is an old, old picture. Okay, and the most striking feature of this picture, which you can already see at this stage, is that the DNA is much, much, much longer than the typical bacterial scale. Okay. So, in fact,
that means already. Well, maybe that would be not long.
What? You're talking about me or about the typical?
Okay,
I don't know. Okay. But this was done a long time ago. I don't remember who did this picture. The spill out?
Yeah.
I don't think. A little bit, but typically what people have seen is that the DNA spills out. And if you prefer to go with the approach that you suggested, now it is known that if you open up the molecule, it is really a very long object. We're talking about a millimeter and a half in length. And all that you have to pack into the bacterium, which, as I said before, is about a micron in diameter. So, we will see. I won't give you a number, but it has not been measured. So, so the cell, the prokaryotic cell, just like its eukaryote cousins, has had to solve this problem of compacting the genome. And after millions of years of, billions of years of evolution, there has been a solution to this problem. The solution, I must point out, already at this stage is different from that of eukaryotes, and you will see later in more detail why this is so. So the compaction in bacterial cells is achieved by essentially three different strategies. The first one is supercoiling. The molecule is not just a closed circle, but before being, it has supercoil configurations, and there's a picture talks much more than 1,000 words, so you can see what a supercoil what I mean by a supercoil configuration. It's this kind of writhe twisted configuration that you have there. Then you have another effect. It's called macromolecular crowding, and this refers to the fact that the cytoplasm in the cell is not a dilute set of proteins. It's very concentrated, and that in itself will induce, through entropic effects, further compaction of the DNA. And last but not least, the third factor, which is important, is the association of the DNA with a set of proteins. It's a group of about 10, and they have been called histone-like proteins or nucleotide-associated proteins. Though at this stage, I want to emphasize that the name histone-like, I will be using it to refer to common usage, but there is absolutely no homology between the sequence of these proteins and histones. Okay, so in a certain sense, it's a misleading name. But the fact that DNA in the cell is not bare and is all the time studded with proteins, you can appreciate in this picture, in which you see that when you pull out a piece of DNA from the bacterial cell, it has a lumpy structure, okay? You can see this photograph is also a little bit old. It's like kind of beads. Of the nucleoid? Well, yeah, but it is distributed. If you saw the picture, I will later show another picture. It's not a completely compact object. It's distributed in the cell. Half a micron, yeah. What? 2 microns. The bacteria is 2 microns in length and 1 micron in diameter. So it's a little bit smaller than, yeah. So let's go back to these histone-like proteins. I have put here a partial list of these proteins. They are about 10, 12. And the first thing that you will see is that they are very abundant. We're not talking about your typical regulatory protein, which can appear in a few tens, few hundreds of copies. No, these proteins, IHF, HNS, HU, FIS, and others, appear in very large numbers. Here we're talking about concentrations of about 30 micromolar, typical. And not only that, but these numbers can change quite a bit, depending on the phase in the life of the bacterium and on environmental conditions. For example, this protein FIS typically increases by orders of magnitude when there is a nutrient upshift in the cell. IHF, when you go into stationary phase, increases quite a bit in number. Okay, So this is a very striking feature. So today, I will talk about the first three of these proteins. We have made experiments on them. 20,000.
Actually, 20,000 copies is what, about 20 micromolar?
Yeah, about, yeah. Now, one thing of caution that you should take into account, the errors in these numbers are large. You will see that one author says that HU is 30,000. The next one will say that it's 40,000 or 50,000. But, okay. Okay, so but they're very numerous. Okay.
Slightly relevant question.
Yeah.
Are there analogs of this in Archaea
too? I don't know. I don't know. I really don't know.
In Archaea seems to have a few things that are more like eukaryote like in the material.
We have to check it in the web. I really don't know. Okay, I haven't thought about that. So now I will start focusing on the first one of these proteins. So this is called IHF, integration host factor. The most striking feature, and I want to say this at the outset, is that IHF is the protein which bends DNA the most in prokaryotes. Okay? As you can see in these pictures, and these are not just schematic pictures, but they come from crystallography. The DNA bend is bent by about 160, 180 degrees. It's a huge, huge bend. And IHF is able to do that by using three mechanisms. It first inserts proline residues here in the minor groove. This is a minor groove binding protein. Then there are electrostatic interactions and a network of hydrogen bonds here at the bodies. This will be important for what I will say later. And it is precisely this property of very high bending which gives to IHF its functionality. First of all, this, I forgot to say, and this is very important, this is done at special consensus sites. This is a high affinity interaction with a sequence-specific piece of DNA. Now, IHF, due to this property of bending, forms part of a large higher order structures which participate in a lot of DNA transactions. For example, it is one of the proteins that helps to integrate the lambda DNA into the bacterial genome. So, and that's one of the reasons why the protein is called IHF. It integrates the genome, the lambda into the genome.
Are we to expect that about 20,000 of them more or less are stuck to DNA somewhere or the other?
We will talk about that later. I will answer that later. It participates in a lot of process in the control of gene expression, both in repression and activation. It helps promote bending of DNA so that distal sequences may approach one another. So the loops that we've been hearing about in different lectures are many times facilitated by the binding of IHF somewhere in the middle to promote these bending. So also, because of this property, it has a lot of industrial uses. Yeah, there are many companies which allow you to put things into the DNA, and they use the integrase and IHF to insert molecules into the cell. I know that there's such a company. Okay. All right. So here is I'm approaching to the point where I will answer your question. So one of the puzzles of IHF is the following. If it has sequences of high affinity, okay, high specificity, why is it found in the cell in such a large number? Typically, in cells, when you have proteins that recognize specific sequences, somehow the numbers are smaller. Okay? Regulatory proteins, as you all know, we can find them in tens or hundreds of copies, but not more. But why does a cell need these high numbers? As far as I'm aware of, and yes?
Where does high specificity come from? How do you know that high specificity?
It has been measured. It has been measured at this site where the crystallography was done. And you're talking about dissociation constants in the nanomolar regime. These are strong sites. Okay? Yes, yes. Okay?
But it's not particularly special to IHS because about for most transcription factors, if you have sequences near the consensus set,
yes,
you pretty much tend to start binding at nanomolar.
Yeah.
But I guess so what you're saying is given that what's different is the time number compared to.
Right, but then you would think that, you know, if you provided other sequences away from the consensus, you would bind two of them.
Well, we will see what we think is the solution to this. Okay?
So, so I guess the question is, I don't see the contradiction.
Right.
Okay? If you are trying to say that there are only few sites, maybe that's the contradiction. If you say, you believe biologically there are only 600 sites that are important.
Okay, some algorithms by people, I think it's in Denmark, a guy called David Usery, I don't know. They looked at the E. coli chromosome and they found that there are on the order of 600 of these sites.
But that algorithm is not a separate black box. It's related to the same question. Okay, that, you know, how did they choose the threshold of the thing? It's exactly related to, you know, what concentration did they think is the important thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so should that 600 should not be taken without that grain of salt.
Okay.
And most of the algorithms,
it's completely arbitrary.
Fine. Okay. Okay, so I would be very interested in knowing what your algorithm finds. Okay, still having a lot, as far as I know, the specific sites that people have looked at, maybe by looking at specific genes, cannot match these large numbers. So,
but this is the whole point. Most of the sites,
yes,
you know, these sites every 200 base pairs.
Yeah.
And not strong sites like the ones that will pick to do crystal structure.
Okay. So what I'm,
you know, not nanomolar sites.
I don't want to tell you the result of what we think is happening before I show you all the rest. But essentially what you're saying is true. That's where our results take us.
Okay. Also, just to sort of interrupt you once more. That most algorithms try to look for a sequence, direct sequence similarity. And what bending things, sort of, you know, bending protein sequence, like the different kinds of algorithms you look for.
Okay. So I'm not familiar with the type of algorithm that they use, so I'm quoting just the result of their paper.
I think, I mean, what seems like discrepancies here, so say that you take a piece of DNA, which is experimentally very substrate.
Right. You can always look for things which are similar to that. But that's not always good at detecting something that's very
far.
Anyway, we'll argue later.
Okay. Yeah, you'll argue later. You. Okay, now, biochemists have also found that most of the IHF localizes in the nucleus. Okay? You can attach probes.
What
nucleoid. The nucleoid. Okay? While you have micromolar, tens of micromolar amounts, the free amount of protein is on the order of nanomolar. They have quantified that by different means. So the question is, what is the function of the bound protein and the nature of the binding sites? Can we say something about these binding sites, about their affinity, for example? And
I guess probably what the Danish gentleman did,
yes, is
actually look for sites with very strong similarity to those high affinity sites and compile some smaller samples.
Very possibly. Very possibly.
Which is not entirely unexpected. And then most of the sites, weaker sites with perhaps KD much closer to micromolar.
Right. Yeah, I don't want to expand on this. I don't think it's fair to the audience, but
a big
conundrum, you know? It's not a big conundrum, but okay, Boris, let me put it this way. Go to the stationary phase, multiply this number by 6, and this is the number of IHFs that you find, and then you have an issue. It's not clear. If you multiply this number by 6, okay, or by 5, yeah, you won't have that number of sites, because this is what happens. Because when you go into stationary phase, the number of IHF goes, yeah, goes up.
Goes up?
Yeah.
By
far. Yeah. Yeah.
And one has the same question. Okay. In eukaryotes, when you see certain decoration patterns, is this because of specific sites, or is this some problem of like beads on a string with some sort of random environment that you'll have a pattern based on interactions among the particles more than just identifying specific sites?
Well, I don't want to expand on this. I really don't want to expand on this. But what I do want to say is that part of the confusion is because this artificial division into specific and non-specific, okay? And you will see that that's one of the conclusions of the game. Yeah.
Micromolar,
tens of micromolar. There are tens of micromolar in the cell.
You are talking about cytosolic or one whole atom?
Yeah, it's nanomolar.
Yeah.
No, you have so much protein, you have such an abundance of protein that it. I didn't measure it, but it was measured by biochemists. That's what I know. And also, well, okay, people also did fusion proteins. They put GFP to IHF, and they saw it colocalizes in the nucleoid. It doesn't disperse. Okay? That's a different thing. Sure. 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 No, that's besides that. Yes.
We have to do that in gel ships. We usually use this salt thing and cut down non-specific binding. Okay. So I think even as a reference point for things like sigma 70, 30 nanomolar is the number for the free solution concentration that you should use. Okay, for cellular modeling at least. Okay, which means roughly 30 free proteins in the thing, but there are thousands of them bound to the DNA. So maybe this. This idea that micromolar is where non-specific binding happens in this artificial in vitro experiment, right? So it should be in tens of nanomolar. Because tens of nanomolars is what you take for sigma 70 for the free cytosolic concentration.
I don't understand where this nanomolar. But you see, look, I think it's important to argue about this a little bit because the literature is very, very muddled about this.
Yes.
And this is really quite fundamental.
Yes.
And
so model.
It would be useful to actually find out whether this is.
I will find out that paper.
This is a real number and there is a real conundrum, or this is just somebody's confusion that infected the literature.
Well, definitely the literature is infected, and not only by this.
Take some piece of DNA, which is experimentally well studied. Right? So we can date it here that the desired rep concentration, which is 20,000, is the same as the Asian aspect. But if you see on this experiment with saturated piece of DNA, much more Asian S than I Asian, then you do have this kind of
discrepancy. So it's you're basically saying that this one basically sticks in the favorite site on the plasmid. The plasmid will be equilibrating with free cytosol DNA, right? And free cytosol
no, I'm sorry.
It's quite visceral.
I'm just listening.
I mean, it's much more simple statements, right? So take a piece of DNA and compare experimentally how many HNS and IHL bind to them, right? So the claim here is that the free concentration of IHL, the HNS, are something like equal, right?
At all, right?
Okay. But if you find much more HNS binding sites on that piece of DNA, just experimentally, than IHL, then you do have this contradiction. And I think this is really what you see. I mean, people usually claim that there are much more HNS binding sites.
It's I'm not trying to win. Okay. So the problem there's an experimental problem when you deal with this thing, with these issues, and this is because the usual biochemical techniques are geared to study strong interactions, high affinity interactions. When you take proteins and they interact weakly with your piece of DNA, and for example, you want to make a gel shift, then you can strip them off in the gel. If you want to visualize the structures, you have to dry the molecules to see them in the electron microscope, so you may also strip them away. And so it's, of course, much easier to study things that interact strongly with DNA. So what we did is take an alternative approach, and let me see, do I see biologists here? No, so I was going to be very pedagogic, so I will just flash through this much faster. So what we do is we take a DNA molecule, anchor it at one end from a surface, the other end we stick it to a bead, and then what we do is we apply a force on the bead, and in that way we stretch the DNA. And all this is taking place in solution. What is the advantage of doing such an experiment? The advantage is that the molecule, first of all, is in solution. It is free to fluctuate. Okay? And second, it is able to exchange proteins with the solution freely. Okay? So the perturbation is much smaller than with usual techniques in biology. So when you stretch DNA, I just want to give you some intuition. You have at least that up to intermediate forces, you have two regimes. One in which the DNA is relaxed, so the DNA you can regard it as a violin string that is not taut, so it can explore, due to thermal fluctuations, many configurations. And when you pull the bead towards stretching, you're limiting more the number of conformations that the DNA molecule is able to adopt. That will cost you free energy through entropy, and so you will experience a force. Finally, there's another regime in which the DNA is already tauter and you're already pulling against the material. So, and that would be more the enthalpic regime. So if one would plot a picture or plot a graph of extension versus force, what one would see is a picture like this, and this is in linear scales, where the entropic regime essentially is this part of the curve, and you can understand it more or less on intuitive grounds. If you pull just a little bit, you move a little bit in force, you get a big extension. Whereas the enthalpic regime, where you're already playing against the material, you have to really apply a large force in order to get some extension, and that's the other part of the curve. And what I just want to illustrate is that this is very different from the normal hook and spring, hook and elasticity that you're used to. Yes? Not yet, but we plan it. So, I'm sorry? More or less here it's linear. Okay. So, this I put more for biologists because they won't see this picture. We typically plot the log of the force to open up this regime a little bit more, so that you see how the plots look like. So the way we do the experiment is we have, as I told you, a molecule anchored. We have a magnetic bead. This is what we observe through the objective. And we can approach with a pair of magnets from the top. And in that way, we exert a force on the bead. And by changing the height of the magnets, we can change the force on the bead, and therefore the force going through the DNA. And to determine the force and the extension, to make these force extension plots, we will use the equipartition theorem. I don't want to go into detail now. If you want, I can tell you about later. I just want to go into more interesting things. But I just want to show you that essentially, you need to measure the force and the extension of the molecule. And to do that, you need, of course, to know KT and the amplitude of transversal fluctuations. And this is what is meant by the amplitude in the variation of this quantity, the division from the center. So if we take DNA, which is relaxed, you can see that its fluctuations amplitude fluctuations are small, while for DNA which is taut, the fluctuations are much smaller. Okay, and we didn't devise this technique. Magnetic forcing was first used by Bustamante to measure stretching on DNA, and then this technique was later used to a much larger extent by the group of Ben Simon and Colquette. Okay, so that's to measure force. To measure height, what we do is we make a library of pictures at known different heights. To show you how this is done, let me refer to your intuition, and let's look at the bead while you defocus it. When you take a bead and you defocus it, its image changes quite a bit. It develops Newton rings at different heights. So what you can do is make a displacement of your objective by known amounts, take an image at each height, and then in that way you compile a library of images with which you can compare your instantaneous image and thereby deduce the height of the molecule, of the bead. So typically what you get is something like this, and look at the squares. And these squares you can describe very well by the worm-like chain model. Essentially, you can get a closed expression that is not far from the observed data. And this closed expression, or this model, has two length scales in it. First of all, the length, the overall length of the molecule, and also the persistence length, which here I symbolize by L naught. So the DNA that we have been using in our experiments is the DNA of the lambda phage. And it typically has a persistent length, depends on salinity, of course, but we're talking about 40, 50, 60 nanometers. So what we will do in our experiment is to put the proteins in and see how this curve changes. So that's the strategy. And what happened? Okay. So this is the bulk of our measurement on IHF. So I would like to walk you through the data. So bare DNA is the red points. This is essentially a curve like the one I showed you before. And then let's look at the magnified portion of this region where the deviation is larger. So this is here shown at the inset. So if I put on the order of 250 nanomolar IHF, I see these stars, these black stars, and you can clearly see that for a given force, the extension has gone down. You add more IHF, the extension goes down further, okay? So you're starting to compact your DNA, and essentially, what we have observed in our experiments at this amount of salt, at this fixed amount of salt, is that at levels of 500 nanomolar or above, the IHF behavior saturates. So what we see here, the curve that we see here, either by the green squares or the triangles, these were obtained by either going up or down, so there's no hysteresis, is essentially the same at this concentration as it was for about 500 nanomolar. So we get some saturation, and this is an important feature of these experiments, which will lead us to one of our main conclusions. So we get yes.
If you reduce the salt level, does it move further?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, but I'm sorry, I don't have that data. I will show you data with another protein, but yes.
Sure.
Yes. 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 Yes, you're right. Yes, sure. Sure. Yeah, I will show you later with H2.
This is actually the explanation of all this, that idea that macromolars are needed to do non-specific binding. That in lower salt concentrations, they actually bind at much lower concentrations. Okay.
Another point that this saturation is important, and we also got hold of a mutant. In which there was just one point mutation, one amino acid was changed, and people saw that the activity of IHF in the cell went down by 100%. And when we use this mutant in our experiment, we see that its elastic properties are very much like that of bare DNA in a fashion which is consistent with these in vivo findings. So how can you say something quantitative about these curves? After all, you saw that there were lines drawn through the data. So in order to do so, we used, back then when we did these experiments, the only model that was existent then of the elastic properties of DNA bound to protein. It's a model by Marco and Sigia. And today, I understand that there is a model that is able to deal with different situations. That's a private communication by John Marco. And essentially, it's a two-state model in which it is assumed that the fraction of DNA length occupied by the protein is given, and that you assume that each protein, when it binds, it absorbs some length. So I won't go into the details of the model as I understand it, but essentially you have the contribution to the free energy of the worm-like chain model. You have the energetic contribution due to the binding of the protein, and an entropic term, which is just the entropy of mixing, the way which describes the conformation of the possible combinations of the protein on the DNA. So when you go and apply this this model to your elasticity data, at least in the part where you have saturation of the behavior, you can get some numbers out. Okay, and what struck us then is that we saw on the order of 80 proteins bound. So this effect could be gotten by 80 proteins. The dissociation constant that comes out is in the micromolar range, so it more or less fits the concentrations that we were using. And from the model, you could also see that the compaction rate along the contour of the molecule would be relatively high. So even though the statement is more or less trivial, if you would assume just from geometric, just from the size of the protein, how much IHF you could put along the lambda DNA molecule, you would obtain a number which is a lot higher. So are these numbers plausible? Can you get independent confirmation of these numbers? And you want to do so because these fits are multi-parameter fits. Okay. Yes.
What is S and L1?
Okay. S they have their phenomenological parameter, which is the amount of the length of DNA that is effectively absorbed by the binding of one protein. And psi is the concentration, the fraction of DNA covered. Well, this will.
So, how the polymer to think about? So, suppose the IHF is a strong bender, so
yeah,
it puts in these hairpins.
Yes.
So, I can therefore imagine that each IHF takes out, reduces the length of DNA by one.
Something like what you're saying is what you see here in this picture. This is precisely.
With 180 turns, would have been loss of one persistence length.
Oh, two, right. Persistence, yeah.
And straight would be.
And so 200 base pairs is roughly
half of it.
Yeah, more or less.
Length, or
yeah, yeah. Sure. But I was thinking about one persistence length on this side and one on this. More or less, yeah. But what you're telling what this picture, which is intuitive picture I had in my mind, is.
But if you take this picture, then it has consequences for, it has predictions for, things as a function of salt. And
yes.
It will say that air has to grow to, one micron as you,
yeah.
Right.
Sure.
But then, of course, KD is changing also.
Yeah.
But all this is fit at a single salt condition. Of, from the data as a function of IGF concentration.
No, this we did just at where we saw saturation. This is just for one IGF concentration. This, it comes out from the model.
You assume
that it could sit anywhere on the DNA.
Yes.
Every base pair.
That's, I think, what the model assumes.
I guess
yes.
You can, because if you extend, you have.
That's what the model assumes.
Lose a few guys. So if you pull very strongly, all
yes.
Of them have to be lost in the solution.
Yes.
Okay. So the model in the slope of that extension curve should know something about KD.
Yes.
So this model, you had two IHFs next to each other.
Yeah.
You get much less than two S clusters in it.
Yeah, I mean, this is a mean field model. I don't think it will take into account anything that, like the effects that you're saying, which are more correlations. Right.
So what anyone just explained was that just as a function of force.
Yes.
Right,
you may strip off.
One should expect to see a kink, right, where force times S.
Yes. Yes. We don't.
But we don't see any kink like this.
In this parameter, right.
And they pop out.
Yeah, at this parameter, exactly, we don't see that kink.
But then, of course, but, you don't really expect to see it because there isn't a single KB,
right?
It's all spread out.
Yes.
So is that John Marco de Coupe model, or?
No, this is the first, this is the first thing. And in the improved model, what he tells me is that he's not assuming now any length absorbed, that he's already assuming.
Realistic geometry, but every side is the same.
I think still, yes. I think so, yes. Now, so there are some fitting parameters here, and you would like to get maybe some independent, an independent confirmation of these numbers to see that you're really taking out right numbers from the experiment. So, of course, with so many fit parameters, you could take an elephant and fit it behind, and I will show you that this is right. Okay. So, but of course that doesn't let me off the hook. So the only thing that I would. So what? Still, I refer to my question. So, I will say in the two things. First of all, two of these parameters, the persistence length and the length of the DNA, are very well clamped by the measurements. They vary by a lot of length scales. So we trust these parameters. But what about the others? So, in order to get at least to count the number of proteins on the DNA, how can 80 proteins plus minus give rise to such an effect? We used a time-honored technique of molecular biology. This is called cross-linking, and I was not aware of it before I started this experiment, so I assume that some of you will not be aware of it. So essentially what you do is you bind the protein to your DNA, like if you were doing an ordinary experiment. You just make your DNA radioactive, you will see why, and then you add a compound that what it does is it creates a covalent bond between the protein and the DNA so that the protein cannot leave the DNA anymore. Is it known what?
How close the amino acid residues have to be to the DNA before you can cross-link?
I don't know. That's really a high-resolution question. Of course, one other thing that I want to say is that you have to, of course, as in biology, make controls. So in order to avoid, for example, that when you add your liquid, this formaldehyde is a liquid, that proteins that are in solution will bind more and more on the DNA. First of all, you do controls. One of the controls is you can take the bare DNA and add the formaldehyde with a protein, and you see that seems to be no binding. Second, you inject an amount of formaldehyde that dilutes the solution so much that the chance of the protein hitting the DNA is really very tiny.
So,
yes.
How much formaldehyde do you
how much is your optimal thing to not bind to non-specific DNA?
I didn't catch the question. So
the amount of formaldehyde that you think is optimal, okay, for this thing.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
If you have figured that out, that's useful for us.
Okay.
Can you also control with something that you know has specific binding sites and you can quantify with known strong binding sites, but you some other transcription factor or something like
that? I will answer that more in the end. In fact, All this was started with very, we started experiments. Well, it's a little bit of history, but I will answer your question later. So, if you engineer such a molecule, yes, there is no reason why you shouldn't be. Yeah. So what you do is you put in a tube bare DNA, your cross-linked complexes, and cesium chloride, and then you start spinning your tube for a long, long time. And in our experiments, what we needed to do is to centrifuge for 64 hours at a very, very high rotational speed. And then what happens is that you develop a gradient in your cesium chloride, okay? And in this gradient, the bare DNA and your complexes assume isodensity conditions. So they go at different heights. They're both labeled, so you know where they are. And then the next step is you drill a little hole at the bottom of your tube, and you collect the fractions. You can try. But you have to rotate too, and then what you do is you can measure the density of each of the fractions that you obtain by measuring the refractive index of the particular sample. So this is what you do, and when you do so, you obtain the following picture. So this is the density, and this is the radioactivity. So for bare DNA, you should look at the dark circles. So you get a peak here. The mutant that had no effect neither in the elasticity nor in vivo appears very near to it. But when you put the cross-linked molecule with IHF, you see a measurable deviation, and from the width, and from this deviation, you can deduce the amount of proteins that there are stuck on the DNA, because you know the parameters of the protein and of your DNA. So what we get is that we get on also from the width of this peak on the order of 60 to 150 IHF molecules per lambda DNA at this salt concentration in which we did the experiment, which is the same salt concentration we use for the elasticity. So the numbers more or less fit. Yes?
60 per lambda DNA, how much does your E. coli if you just extrapolate?
Well, it's 50,000, it's about a factor of 100, right? Okay, lambda DNA is on the order of 50, and let's take 5 million for, yeah, so it's a factor of 100 roughly. Okay.
But how would the IHF concentration of the experiment compare with immunological concentration?
That's a very tricky question, which I don't think that I have managed to solve completely.
Sorry, but you know what concentration you have here, and you told us what the concentration
in the cell is. Okay, we're using much lower concentrations. We're using micromolar concentrations, whereas you have 30 micromolar in the cell.
Yeah.
Okay?
But
not only
micromolar, so you're down by a factor of 10.
Yes.
But then the salt is not particularly physiological.
Oh. The concentration of salt we used is more or less physiological level, 200 Okay, feel with that, that's what we use. It's more or less physiological level. Yeah. Okay.
If you change the level of cross-linking agents, then these numbers will change.
If I change the number of what?
Formaldehyde.
No, no, no. We added so much formaldehyde that it diluted the sample completely. The change, this is what I was trying to say. This measurement, the measurement would be a stupid measurement if it would depend on the amount of formaldehyde that you use. You add so much formaldehyde that you dilute your sample so much that just the proteins that were bound at the DNA at the time of addition are the ones that will be cross-linked. Okay? So, the known consensus, what? Well, like everything, it has its tricks. So
well, the issue is that if the protein is always, I don't know, the amine group gets, I don't know, sort of attacked by formaldehyde or something.
Yes.
And then it can go in and accidentally touch
yes.
the major groove at a place energetically. It's slightly unfavorable.
Yes.
It gets stuck. This is the question that is
but I think what the way Joel just explained it is very different. He's sort of explaining it as sort of rapid question.
Right.
Yeah.
Saying that,
no,
that it's dumping so much formaldehyde that it's going to cross-link before the protein will equilibrate in the new.
Sure. You know, you're yes.
But you're not taking away formaldehyde, right? So you know, that's related to the question actually that the guys were just hanging around here.
Well,
not deep into.
Okay. Well, what I told you is that we also did this control of having put bare DNA and inject the and inject. Okay. So.
So the protein concentration is low in some way.
Right. Okay.
So you have, Marco kindly did the effort of trying to find the consensus sites of IHF on lambda, and he finds on the order of 20 IHF sites on lambda. So still, the numbers that we get both from both experiments, both from elasticity and the cross-linking, are a little bit higher than these consensus sequences.
You know, that's the consensus only, but that's what bioinformatics would predict from, estimate,
sure.
concentration,
okay. Okay, so the question is whether you can say something about the affinity. You still have more proteins binding than what you obtain also from this bioinformatic approach. So the question is whether, yes?
Okay. So, I mean, in principle, for each binding site, you will be able to assign some number of probabilities, right?
Mm-hmm.
That the protein is found, right? But then, in some sense, the question starts where you put the threshold, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Sure.
I mean, how to distinguish?
You could change the threshold and get more.
Right. And I would somehow think that, you know, this change of thresholds should correspond to some way changing, for example, formaldehyde concentration or salt concentration.
So salt concentration, formaldehyde, no, but salt, yeah. Salt, I'm willing to buy that number will change.
In
yes.
In some sense, also in your experiment, you effectively, in some way, change the threshold.
Sure. Yes. Yes.
A little bit tricky. I mean, you can definitely say what are the strong binding sites.
Yes. Yes. So can you say something about the affinity of these sites? And in order to do so, we repeated the elasticity experiments, but now putting into the solution a non-specific competitor. This competitor is a kind of variant of DNA. It's called DI. DC, don't ask me exactly what the I stands for, but it can bind proteins non-specifically, so the proteins can go in and out, bind and unbind from this competitor. And then you do the elasticity experiments in the presence of that competitor. And what you see is that if you do not add the competitor, I haven't told you what I'm plotting. So this is the height of the bead relative to the height when you don't add any IHF at a given force. Okay, so I fix a force where we have maximum deviation between the curves, elasticity curves. So this is about 150 nanometers. And so what I want to check here is, if I add my competitor, will I see a deviation? Oh, picony, I'm sorry, picony. No, not picon theater. No, it's fine. No. Sure. 60, it's less than a piconewton, yeah, femtonewtons. Sure, thank you. Sure. When you add the competitor, you see that as you add IHF, nothing happens. That means that the competitor is able to compete for the protein. However, if there is no competitor, you see the reduction that we already saw. So a non-specific competitor is able to compete for the effects, for the elasticity effects with these sites on the lambda. So we have now two ingredients. So at least in the salt concentration that we're using, we got some saturation with an order of about 100 IHF molecules. And we have competition, successful competition by a non-specific competitor. And the interpretation that we give to this is what we said in the very beginning, and that's what you also have been pushing for, that that you have sites which have slightly lower affinity, but the truth is that we have a spectrum of affinities. We cannot talk only about completely about an artificial division of absolutely non-specific between a highly specific, as some biochemists put forth many years ago. I think it was von Hippel, right? So let me summarize what we know now from about the IHF from these experiments. IHF is a charged protein, and yet when you add it, the complex still retains some random coil configuration. The DNA does not collapse. That's a typical question that people asked. If you ask, for example, if you add a multivalent salt to DNA, the DNA really collapses. Here, this is not the case. It still retains a random coil configuration. We don't see full coverage of the molecule. We see on the order of 100 proteins at this salt concentration. The only way to rationalize the fact that we have this saturation effect and competition by non-specific competitor is that we have sites with a spectrum of affinities. And even at these sites, in order to be able to observe the bending that you have, the change in elasticity, you must have a significant bending also at these sites. If you try to quantify the compaction along the contour of the molecule, we're talking about tens of percents. So it's a sizable effect, but I do not think that it will give you the largest compaction that you could expect in order to get to the degree of compaction of the nucleoid. That will be done by other proteins, as I will show you at the end of the talk. And well, the mutant, the experiments with the mutant more or less agree with the results of, yes. Wait. Start from the beginning. Forget about this point. I mean, I should really have taken it off. Yeah.
Cost to
bend
in the DNA?
Sure.
And is that consistent with
I don't think that DNA will be bent by 180 degrees or 160 degrees like it is bent. Yeah, I don't think that. It will bend, but not by that amount. But we cannot quantify from these experiments.
In one case,
the 180 bent occurs within whatever
35 base pairs.
So it's really completely outside the realm of elasticity of the.
Sure.
But there's a sequence dependent energy event there,
which has to be
the bending is not independent of the sequence at the bend point. So there are contact energies.
Yes.
Okay, and bending energies, and
yes.
Both have to be combined together in the specific affinity, which right there is a story threshold.
For all practical purposes, you disrupt local stacking.
Well, usually the threshold would be
very
like
favor of making the contact with protein.
Yes.
When
you go to the binding state, right, but once you get to the binding state, you can figure out the free energy of that.
Sure.
Right, like forcing it to the binding state.
Sorry to return to
Yes.
So that, of course, made the remark, which is completely correct.
Yes.
Seems perfectly consistent. So if you could just estimate.
Yes.
So the average KD.
Yeah.
Of equaling DNA sequence.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. All of your IHF.
Yeah.
The estimate is half a micromole.
Half a micron.
And whatever 10^6 sites will account for your
20,000. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So let's also imagine that lambda also has some average KD for IHF.
Yes.
But now you're loading it with not nanomolar free.
But micromolar. Yeah.
But micromolar.
Yes.
So according to this, it should be completely saturated.
Yes.
Boom.
Yeah.
So you should have 10,000 binding sites, right?
Yes.
And not 100.
Yeah.
Now we have a conundrum.
Now we have a conundrum.
Okay. So basically, either we have a conundrum here or we have a conundrum there.
So let me tell you about what we found with HNS. HNS is a completely different protein. We already heard about it from Arkin's talk. It, as opposed to IHF, it's a small neutral protein. It's not charged. It has a DNA binding domain, which is very different from every known binding domain. It's on its own. Okay? It has its full structure itself. The protein alone has not been mapped. There is some knowledge of the binding domain from NMR, and that's the way people are able to say that it is different from any other known structure. And the N-terminal domain seems to be, its function seems to be in protein-protein interactions. And No. As I said in the beginning, none of these proteins have a homology with histones. And in any case, histones are highly basic. This is completely, it's very neutral.
So
yes.
I had a question about the first half of the talk.
Yeah.
So what about finding the binding sites for these 100 proteins by some protection assay or something? I mean, you have this lambda, you could ask.
In principle, it could be.
I think there are some specific sites.
Yes.
Some non-specific sites, but are they more or less the same sites every time you do the experiment, or is it moving all over?
It's a legitimate question. My only concern is that if you go and do it, since these sites, you expect the proteins to go on and off, your foot, you will get nothing in your footprint. That would be my guess.
Well, you're doing this, you do this binding assay, right? Where you bind it.
Well, if you may, after adding formaldehyde.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe. Yeah, maybe adding formaldehyde. I don't know if in that case you can, after adding the formaldehyde, whether you can strip it off. That I'm not aware of. Good idea. So what is known about how HNS participates in regulation? Well, it has been found that on the order of 5% of the genes in E. coli are in some way affected by HNS. And it's a very large number of genes, on the order of 200, 300. And what is common about these genes is that they're associated with responses to environmental changes, like, for example, cold shock, changes in temperature, changes in pH, in osmolarity. And when you look at the literature and you try to find out how can HNS be involved in these changes, what at least I invariably found is that it's hard to say, because when you do these changes, there are changes in the supercoiling state of the molecule. So changes of HNS were ascribed to supercoiling changes. That's what I managed to see. Now, there are other researchers in biochemistry which have shown, and this is when doing really molecular biology and looking at the activity of particular promoters and what can uplift it or downgrade it, is that many of the genes that are affected by HNS seem to have sequences in which the HNS has high affinity upstream from the promoter of these genes. And not only that, but these binding sites, these high affinity sites, are sometimes hundreds of base pairs away from the promoter. Okay, so the idea that some people had is that perhaps what HNS does is it first binds to these binding high affinity binding site, and then it polymerizes along DNA until you can get you can block the promoter, and in that way you can repress these the genes that HNS typically repressed. HNS is a global regulator, and it typically acts by repressing. So this is the idea that people had about how it works. The problem is that this idea is not consistent with the structural findings that people had. And this is what you will see here. Everything started with investigations of Henri Bouc in 84 and his group, and they did sedimentation in sucrose gradients, and they saw a huge effect, and they interpreted that effect as saying that DNA is highly compacted by the protein. I think that even is found in the title of their paper. And subsequently, that idea, I think it's one of the maybe ideas that are not particularly well-based and have found their way in the literature, and they're widely quoted. There are other pieces of information which tended to form the view that HNS compacts strongly. Here you can see wild-type cells with the nuclei distributed. And when you overexpress H and S, as in this picture, I hope that you can see, I don't know if the illumination is right, the nucleoid is forming a more compact, near quasi-spherical shape, much more compact than in more in these more distributed pictures. So these sort of experiments, plus the sedimentation and the fact that it binds to curved DNA preferentially, shaped this view that HNS compacts DNA strongly, and this somehow seemed incompatible with the fact that HNS can act like a silencer, as I showed you in two view graphs before. Then people tried to visualize HNS DNA complex, and this is a more recent picture by a Dutch group, and I want you to focus on this picture in particular. They put DNA in which they introduced a particular sequence in which you have a high affinity site, and indeed you see HNS bound there, but they didn't see HNS on the other part of the molecule. In contrast, when you go and do electron microscopy, people saw that HNS can coat from end to end. That means it can polymerize along the DNA. So there was a huge inconsistency between the findings of electron microscopy and atomic force microscopy, the findings of sedimentation, and more molecular biology techniques. We showed that HNS could act as a silencer. So again, part of the problem is that yes. No. No.
Okay,
no.
In principle, one can imagine that.
This is much longer. This is much longer than this. Much longer.
But in principle, one can imagine that on the piece of DNA above, you have just one binding site.
Yeah.
And on the piece of DNA below.
Sure, no, but this is much, much longer. Okay? So again, we have a problem of interaction, of weak interaction. So again, elasticity might help. And when you go and do the experiments, this is what you see. Dark circles are bare DNA, and the moment you start adding HNS, what you see is that for a given force, you get a larger extension. Okay? So the way we rationalize that is that HNS could indeed, if you take this picture, that HNS may polymerize from the side, as proposed by people who saw silencing. The interpretation is that you could get polymerization of HNS along the DNA, increase the effective persistence length of DNA, and in that way get larger extensions. In order to be able to do this effect, what you would expect is that HNS would have to bind in large numbers on the DNA. Can we show that? In order to do so, in fact, you can compute a... Oh, so I just wanted to say that, of course, so we see no compaction at the level of single molecules. We find no hysteresis in our experiments, and the data seemed to saturate. We didn't have the necessary concentration to go to saturation, but you can see that as you add more, the difference between 2,000 and 4,000 is small. We shouldn't be too far from saturation, but we didn't reach it in the experiments. So can you quantify the number? Somebody asked something?
Yeah, number.
Yes. Yes.
Is nanomolar?
That I don't know. I don't. What I told you is
so
what.
Here we have to assume that the free cellular concentration
yeah.
is micromolar, or otherwise we're looking in a completely different regime, right?
Yeah. So. here this other collaborator of mine chose to plot experiments, to plot the data in a different fashion. So here what he's giving you is a fraction number, these little droplets that come out from the test tube. And here we have added no H and S. this is the signal of the radioactivity. So we have marker DNA and bare DNA. When you add H and S, you see that the complexes which have been cross-linked with H and S can go to densities which are considerably smaller than the density that you expect from bare DNA, which is given by the marker, which is about 1.7, 1.7 something. That here the change in density is much larger than in the case of IHF. And from it you can deduce that you have, at least for this portion of the molecules, for this fraction, you have on the order of 3,000 HNS molecules per lambda. Okay, and this is about one HNS molecule for every 15 base pairs. Okay, so this is these high numbers are consistent with the fact that you may indeed have a polymerization along the molecule, and in that way increase the persistence length, the effective persistence length. So the picture that we have in our minds is more or less like this. First of all, when you start adding your HNS, HNS would bind to sites of high specificity, high affinity, and these would serve as nucleation sites from which polymerization would ensue. So in this way, you would get a higher extension of your complex than your bare DNA molecule. Since, yes. I think it's on the order of 20 bases, 20, 30, 40, something like that. You must have some 80 sequences in registry with the helical domain, and that makes also the site more bendable. Okay, so given that HNS participates in the detection of environmental signals, what we wanted to do to check is how does this phenomenon depend on temperature. So what we did is we extracted from these plots some sort of an effective persistence length and repeated the experiments for different temperatures. So the persistence length of the complexes, which is what I'm plotting here with the dark points as a function of temperature, goes down and essentially from room temperature, we started more or less at room temperature, and essentially at about 30 degrees, the persistence length of the complexes is more or less the same within experimental error as that of bare DNA. In fact, already at 37 degrees, if you plot the persistence length of the complexes, if they can be called complexes, the curves coincide with that of bare DNA. So what we believe is happening is that when you crank up the temperature already at above 30, there's no much protein along the DNA, and therefore you see no polymerization effect. And what I want to stress is that by construction, by design, we have not bound the DNA neither to the bead nor to the surface in a way that would prevent it to supercoil. That means that there is a single hinge. The DNA cannot support any torsion. So there's no change in supercoiling in this experiment, and yet the molecule, this complex, the DNA HNS complex, is able to act like a thermometer independent of any other factors in the cell. Okay? And what we believe is happening is that the protein is known to have a coil domain. This coil domain in other proteins are sensitive to temperature. This coil domain is in the N-terminal part of the molecule, which is known that there are protein-protein interactions. So our belief, which is consistent, this is the way we rationalize our findings, is that higher temperatures change protein-protein interactions. They essentially make them very, very weak. So, and therefore, you see no polymerization at high temperature. So I didn't show you the results of salt. They are essentially similar. So the surprises that we got is that, as opposed to the widely held view that you find in the literature, HNS does not compact DNA at the level of single molecules. We see polymerization starting from curved high affinity sites. And these complex alone, without any other accessory factors, other proteins or supercoiling, is able to act like a thermometer and sense these environmental changes by itself. The same is with salt.
Osmolarity is not only salt, right? I mean, you can take non-ionic stuff. So why do you particularly call it osmolarity?
Call it salt.
Okay. Salt produces binding.
Salt, yes. Okay. Yes. And now I will just go very fast through our findings of HU. This is still an experiment in progress, so I cannot show you material which is finished. So HU is a cousin of IHF. It is charged. It is basic. It appears in different conformations in different animals. For example, in E. coli, it's a heterodimer, whereas in other bugs, it can appear as a homodimer.
Can you comment on what happens when you knock these proteins out of the cell, the various proteins you talked about? Are they essential or non-essential?
Okay, good question. I can say something about IHF and HU. IHF, if you knock it out, the cell will live happily. Many of its functions are taken up by HU. The same way you can knock HU out, it seems, and IHF, the cells will be viable.
Live happily in algae culture.
Yes, that's what I read. Now, if you knock both, that I don't know. That would be. A big effect in right. So what we got our hands on two versions of HU. One is that of Bacillus pterothermophilus. This creature lives at about 50 degrees in water of 50 degrees, high, hot. And we also had a little bit of E. coli HU, and they behave somewhat differently. So these are curves, preliminary curves, and disregard the fits for now. Just look at the data for the Bacillus thermophilus protein. So again, we have bare DNA. These are the black points. You start adding HU, and you see a big compaction effect as you increase the amount of HU. We have good evidence that this also reaches some sort of saturation, but I don't have a graph to show you this here. But what I can show you is what happens if I reduce the amount of salt. Okay, so I couldn't show you this for IHF, but you will see for HU. No, disregard that. This is, well, the fit that you see is using the new Marco model, but I don't want to talk about it because this is not finished and we don't trust it well. But in Marco's new model, you put in a bend angle, okay, and a uniform site. And what Bernhard Schnoor saw is that if you assume these two numbers and you change only the concentration as the only parameter, the fit, the curves that you get from the model more or less go with the experimental data. So what happens when you reduce salt from 200 millimolar KCl to 250? The compaction is huge, as you can see here. Okay, really huge. This is, again, bare DNA. And let's say at this value of the force, you go from a 10 micron extension to less than a micron. So this is a compaction in height. As you can imagine, the compaction along the contour will be can be much larger, and that even more at when you go to low forces.
The 9 base pair for binding site came from?
No, not from here. No, this is from the literature. This is from the literature. Okay.
More compaction from 25 than from 100, or is that experimental error?
No, we start seeing that there are complicated saturation effects, and curves can cross. We have seen that. So there is a large degree of homology. There is a large degree of homology. Yeah, well, what you showed was a structure. What I showed in the previous
viewgraph.
Yes.
The HU structure is from another bug, but that's okay.
Yeah, but I think I showed you the structure of HU from Bacillus.
Right.
And the bend angle there is what, also over 180?
No. In fact, since the interaction with people have not bound people. No, people have not been able to make a crystal because the interaction is weaker than with IHF. The co-crystal, right? After the lecture, I may be able to tell you something. Now we're doing FRET experiments with the short sequences, 50 MERS, and we're able to say to quantify that a little bit more. So what people know is that more or less at these concentrations, people have seen the formation of what they call nucleosome-like structure. The DNA is beaded when they add HU to the DNA. I do not know if this sort of structure can explain the compaction effects that we see. This is precisely what we're trying to find out on a more macroscopic scale by doing FRET measurements. But these are the sort of estimates that these people, this French group, got from their measurements. It is possible that these sort of structures may give you the compaction that you need. We don't believe that the large compaction that we see can be accounted for by picturing which a simple single molecule of HU comes and bends locally. The bending is not that large as IHF. I find it hard to swallow. It's a gut feeling. I think it's something more complicated, more along these lines, but that is something that we're trying to see. Our initial measurements, and this I can tell you, is that we seem to see cooperativity in binding. Okay, so when we do these FRET measurements, we see cooperative behavior. We see a Hill coefficient of nearly 3, which would indicate that you don't have a simple DNA binding, but it's a more collective effect. So essentially what I want to do is to finish here. It's already late. So what I hope that these experiments will show you is that these elasticity measurements can really open a new window. They give a high resolution view, which highlights the difference in which these proteins interact with DNA. And but of course, much more needs to be done. We're doing FRET, and we're also starting to work with other proteins as well. We're trying to get our hands on FIS. We have by now DPS. DPS is a molecule that forms a kind of liquid crystalline structure in the nucleoid in high stress conditions. The liquid crystalline structure has been seen in vivo. Okay. So we have that now in the lab, and we're trying to see how it behaves when it complexes with DNA. So that's it.